Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 70. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, social visionary and author, Tom Sein. After the conversation in this episode, I will report on a new service we're offering and also share some of the responses that we've received recently. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. Tom Sein and I worked together on a project when I headed Alternatives for Simple Living in 1995 through 2007. He wrote the biblical reflections for edition number 9 of our best-known Advent Christmas resource, Whose Birthday Is It Anyway? See the link in the show notes. I recently read his new book, Live Like You Give a Damn, Join the Change-Making Celebration. He has a new blog called, appropriately enough, New Changemakers. Tom's classic is The Mustard Seed Conspiracy. His other books include Mustard Seed vs. Macworld, Reinventing Life and Faith for the Future, Cease Fire, Searching for a Sanity in America's Culture Wars, and Live It Up, How to Create a Life You Can Love. Together, he and Christine co-authored Living on Purpose, Finding God's Best for Your Life. At the Mustard Seed House, he's known as Research and Hospitality Guy. Tom and Christine live in an intergenerational community in Seattle. He earned his Ph.D. at the University of Washington. He headed up a development program in Haiti for World Concern, taught at the University of Washington, Seattle Pacific University, and at Fuller Seminary in Seattle. Tom also works to help Christian organizations develop a holistic theology of mission and speaks widely at colleges, churches, and mission conferences around the world. Tom's most recent book, Live Like You Give a Damn, Join the Change-Making Celebration, is accompanied by his new website, Exploring Changemaking and Trends and Stories, at The New Changemakers. You may want to hear an earlier conversation with Tom and Christine when I was visiting them at their Mustard Seed House in Seattle a while back. See the link to episode 28 in the show notes. Also see links in the show notes to his books, audio, video resources, and detailed bibliography. What motivated you to write Live Like You Give a Damn?
I went to a conference in San Francisco called the SOCAP Conference back in September 2013. And it was a conference on social entrepreneurship, community empowerment, Rockefeller Foundation, Bill Gates Foundation, but primarily about 2,000 young people, primarily from the millennial generation, who really wanted to have an impact. So they were trying to learn, how can I become a social entrepreneur, starting businesses that do good by doing well? How can I start a community empowerment project to use the resources of a neighborhood to help people solve their problems instead of sustain people in their dependency? And it tipped me over the edge. I have been concerned and interested in this kind of stuff for a long time, but I had no idea of the kind of impact it could have, nor did I have any idea how many millennials really give a rip and they want to do something to make a difference in their world.
Why have you focused on people under 35?
There's some bad news about the millennial generation, Gen Y and Gen Z. Millennials are 18 to 35, and the younger sisters and brothers, Gen Z, are coming up. The very good news is, because they're the first digital generations, they're much more globally aware. They're aware of global economic injustice, racial injustice, environmental injustice, but most importantly, they want to do something about it. They really want to find a way to use their lives to have an impact. And so they're starting new forms of business, new forms of empowerment. And I just think it would be a really good idea if the church woke up to the opportunity they present. The millennial generation that I'm describing, largely outside the church, I really suspect the Spirit of God is trying to stir the church to move beyond token charity, to really being as committed as these young people are, to real community change, neighborhood change, community empowerment, something beyond two cans of corn in the food bank and a little word on the job for Jesus to something that brings real change.
You use the word change-making. What does that mean?
When I was in my 20s, I was an urban social worker. I worked in Haiti for 7 years for World Concern in a community empowerment project. And I'm convinced that what people need are new ways that move them out of dependency and the kind of chronic victimization that's a part of that. And I'm desperately frustrated that our churches have so little investment in real serious change making. They're satisfied with a little food in a food bank that sustains people in their dependency but doesn't change their lives. More importantly, our churches, while they talk about making a difference, 85 to 95% of the time and money never leaves the building. It's all about the people under the tent. And so if the church is going to have a future, quite literally, we're going to need to change it so they get us involved, we get us involved in working for real change in the lives of people as a central issue, not as a peripheral issue. So I was motivated because I need to change, and this is the first time I've said this in any of the books I've written. I need to get back on the field to play. I need to live like I give a damn. And so I have contacted a group in North Seattle where I live called Lake City Future First, and I'm going to be volunteering and finding out how I can get involved. I'm trying to get people in the church to really change their time styles and lifestyles, to have time to be more present to God and more time to be more present to neighbors. And change making is just moving beyond charity to really helping communities, neighborhoods, and individuals change their lives for the better.
Can you share an example of change making with us?
Well, let me mention one from New Life Covenant Church in Torrance, California. They're a remarkable congregation because the Covenant Church in America is doing some of the most authentically missional church planting. They're planting new churches, half of which are intercultural or multicultural, but where there are no programs for people in the building. They meet for worship once a week. The only other time they meet is in a small home mission group where they talk about how can we make a difference in the lives of our neighbors. They have joined something called Family Promise, which is a new organization. Christians in the business world have created a new way to work with families that are homeless. One of the problems in homeless shelters is that the families get separated for security reasons, which is really not cool. And what Family Promise does is they get a network of churches in Torrance, California to commit, number one, to arranging to keep families intact and rotate them in churches. Number two, to invest a really good chunk of money to get professional social workers that are really good at helping people find jobs. They have a 60-day turnaround for families, helping them find jobs and safe places to live. That is so much better than sustained dependency. So that's one example. And in the process of doing this, two young women in the community, Martha and Helen, were not Christians, weren't a part of the church, but they got so excited about this because they want to be change makers that they got involved and they are now a part of the church. That became a way to both make a real difference in the lives of homeless families and engage millennials in the things that they really care about.
Are there some change makers you're excited about?
There are a bunch. Let me talk about Liz Culver. Liz Culver's one of my heroes. She's a young millennial up Seattle way where I live, working with the ELCA, and she's planning churches called Catacombs. And one of the things they're doing in Catacombs are planning churches that are essentially house churches. They meet twice a month. They have a meal together. They share their stories. They share their struggles. They have a liturgy. But the primary focus of their life together is not coming together twice a month, but political organizing, which is really a strange phrase that you don't hear with churches very often. Mount Vernon, Washington. a house church of eight people, primarily millennials, got together. They were worshiping, and they walked the streets of Mount Vernon and trying to find some way to engage a problem where they could have an impact. And they found out that farm workers were not only not being paid fairly in this community, sometimes they weren't being paid at all. So this small group of eight developed a website in Spanish on how to help these people find justice and get paid for what they did. They developed handouts and flyers in Spanish, grocery stores, restaurants, and they became the organizing center for these farm workers to get justice in their community as a primary part, not an incidental part of their life together as followers of Jesus. Let me give you another one. Part of what I'm really concerned about for the future of our established churches, mainline and evangelical, that doesn't get talked about very much. Not only are all our churches starting to gray and decline, except some ethnic churches, their levels of participation are declining. Regular church attendance, I can remember when it was Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. Now it's once or twice a month. People don't have time to participate in volunteering in their community to make a difference. They don't have time to pray according to the research. Per capita giving has been declining for over four decades as we've gotten to be wealthier and have more discretionary money. It's down to 2.4% is the average per capita giving in the American church. That's going to rip the bottom out of the boat, declining levels of participation. And you and I both remember the days when we used to talk about radical biblical discipleship and lifestyle change. Well, there aren't very many churches that are on that conversation. But one of the new church plants with millennials, Axiom in Syracuse, New York, is a part of the 3V movement. Dan White Jr. and what they talk about is developing a rule of life and a rhythm of life. The rule of life is finding a focus for their lives that directly connects to a sense of God's purposes for justice, for making a difference, and helping people find a focus for their lives. And number two is to find a rhythm. Well, we'll call her Martha. It was a young woman who was raised in a Christian home but hadn't been in church for years, not during college, not after she got out. High school basketball coach. She got involved with Axiom. They helped her develop a rule of life and a rhythm of life. Well, all of a sudden, this woman that was much too busy, not just coaching basketball, but with incredibly active social life and doing extra jobs, when she began to focus, she saw three young women on her team that essentially weren't being parented anymore. Nobody was there for them. She changed her time style. She got out of a lot of her social activities, and she became a full-time mentor on her free time to help these young women with important life choices. That became the focus of her life, and it changed the rhythm of her life. We need all of our churches to help people raise the bar, really go for their best life. Do the stuff that business people do. Business guys that don't have a bit of interest in religion are upping the game like athletes. They're setting goals. They're developing disciplines because both business and social entrepreneurs, there's so much riding on what they're doing. They can't be screw-ups. They've got to answer email. They've got to be on top of their game. And there are a lot of Christians, young and old, that could learn a lot from people outside the church who are learning to live and create their best lives. There's a church in the Twin Cities area in Edina, Wisconsin, called the Colonial Church. They sold some property a couple years ago. They got a couple million dollars. So because they're committed to mission, making a difference, they did something that I've never heard of before. They started holding social enterprise competitions, and they created an organization as a part of their church called Innove, I-N-N-O-V-E. Essentially, they invite 35-year-olds, not just in their church, but the whole Twin Cities area. They don't have to be church-going in that church or any church. Anybody that brings a good idea can enter the competition. Year one in 2013, Leah won the competition. She'd done research, and she found out in the Twin Cities area, there are over 150,000 people that live in a food desert where there's simply no grocery stores, no fresh produce. Her idea was to buy an old municipal bus, and it has been purchased. She has developed a traveling food store with fresh produce and groceries. It's a money-making venture, but it's cheaper than going to stores, and it goes to some of the underserved neighborhoods. She got coaching, she got mentoring, she got business support from people in the church, and she now has her second bus and is going strong. Mike won the second contest, and his concern, 90,000 Somali refugees in the Twin Cities area. The women don't sprechency, they don't speak English, they don't have job skills. He took one of their food items called a samosa, meat-filled pastry, and he's developed a market in the whole Twin Cities area. He is hiring these women at a living wage to do something they grow up knowing how to do. Isn't that brilliant? And it is a form of free enterprise that has huge social impact. We just need to help our churches give out of the building and give a damn. We need to help them discover their neighborhoods. The Parish Collective in Seattle, good friends of mine, who wrote the book The New Parish, talk about getting out in the neighborhood and listening. And we need to help people in our churches go out with our young people and learn to listen, learn to hear, and begin to imagine and create new ways to make a difference, not just to sustain the poor.
You say the following: Jesus is a design opportunity. What does that mean?
Thank you for asking that question. In the days when we used to talk about whole life disciple, what I call whole life discipleship, radical biblical discipleship, so much of the focus was on cutting back and giving up and simplifying. In fact, I have a story when I read Rich Christian's In an Age of Hunger for the first time, I was so motivated, I immediately went to my closet and took out my three suits and kept one sport coat and one pair of slacks so I could do speaking, and took the rest down to the Salvation Army. Well, I went to a speaking situation the next week and realized I'd given away my last pair of slacks too. So I called the Salvation Army and said, I need my slacks back. And they said, hey, there's six stores. You're happy to find them and buy them back from us. So I was lost in space. But in any case, it was all about simplifying and cutting back and giving up. I am captured by Walter Brueggemann's biblical imagination that is the dream of the future of God, not as individual souls being rescued for a non-material something up there. Even as a young convert, sitting on clouds, dinking on harps, really never registered, never rang my bell. And the imagery that we find in his writings and N.T. Wright is the imagery of coming home, not to the clouds, but to a new heaven, a new earth, where healing finally comes to the broken, justice to the poor, sight to the blind, release to the captives. And it is a world made new through the risen Christ. And so the invitation then is to join the radical way of Jesus and to see all of life as a design opportunity, not just living simply and more sustainably, but creating new forms of architecture, designing a range of architecture that brings in hospitality, cooperative living, and the celebration and the feast that we're a part of in design. It means throwing better parties. We need to be pace setters and throwing better parties. We need to be people leading change instead of just dinking around the edges. We need to be pace setters. So I think following Jesus is a radical, wonderful opportunity to see all of life as a design opportunity to raise kids differently, for compassion instead of for economic success, to discover ways to live in mutually supportive communities, because in the future, I think it's going to rock and roll in the next few years, the volatility that we're experiencing politically and economically. So I think all of life becomes an opportunity to invite Christians of all ages to start imagining new ways to live and new ways to work for change.
How can older, established churches engage younger members in areas of justice and social change?
Such an important question. One of the things as I've been doing research for this book, I found that corporations are routinely sitting down with millennials, the age of your son and daughter, and saying, you're a creative lot. And it's true, the millennial generation is very creative. And then they say, we need your ideas on product design. We need your ideas on marketing. We need your help. We need your creativity. It's very unusual to find any church leaders, pastors, lay people in leadership who ever sit down with the under 35 and ask them for their creativity, more importantly, to take that creativity seriously. So what I argue for in the book is that, first of all, pastors and lay leaders sit down with their young people and start to ask them for their ideas about change making in the neighborhood and eventually reimagining the church, but also to sit down with young people out in the community that are not faith-related at all, walk the streets with them, see the human needs, the areas of struggle, and say, what are your ideas for ways to bring real change in this neighborhood? Help both the young people in the building, the young people in the community, to implement their best ideas, like Innovay does, and launch those ideas. And here's the secret sauce. If you take them seriously, their ideas seriously, they will own those ideas. They will own that change making. And with ownership comes participation. Then it becomes their ministry and their church too. And we just need to help leaders wake up to the richness of the imagination and the compassion of Gen Next and find ways to help those young people really give birth. And then the church will have a future.
What role can creativity play?
Part of what we need in the church today is to invite the Spirit of the living God to ignite our imaginations. We desperately need to get back in touch. And we are in a crisis of creativity in the church because for some reason our pastors graduate from seminaries thinking all the innovation's got to come from them. And in fact, one young man told me that his pastor says his congregation lives in terror of him coming back from another conference or having read another book with huge number of ideas for the congregation to implement. Well, the wake-up call we need in the church, we need the creativity of everyone in the building, particularly our young people. I've done a workshop for 3 decades called Imagine That, where I help people research how their neighborhood's going to be different in the next 5 years. Where are the new opportunities, the new challenges? Communities starting to become, have Latino and Hispanic families move in. The cost of housing affects the future. Have them research how their neighborhood is changing to identify new opportunities. Then I remind them of God's purposes are for societal change, not just personal change. And then we put them to work in creativity groups, creating new ways to respond to those changes. And invariably, it's the first time that people in congregations that I've worked with have ever been asked for their ideas. And they love it. They relish it. They come up with great ideas. And then we help them implement their best ideas. We challenge the church in a 10-day window to select which of these ideas out of the 8 to 10 and give life and breath to them. Japanese Presbyterian Church in Seattle some years ago was one of the first. They were a commuter church. They'd moved off of Capitol Hill where they'd lived to the suburbs, and so they would bus in for a good preach to this Presbyterian church on Sunday. But when I did the workshop, they didn't know about the needs today with inner city kids that weren't getting enough help. They started a tutoring program. I also awakened them to the fact that Indo-Chinese refugee people were coming. You know, we're talking early 80s with that wave coming. And they developed a whole range of programs to serve that community. And they went from being a commuter church that did nothing to having 3 or 4 vital ministries because they were asked to imagine new ways to engage not only today's challenges, but tomorrow's opportunities. We need to do that particularly with our young people again. One of the stories from my childhood where my imagination got ignited, San Francisco, first grade, Reading Elementary School. Miss Laverne had us all bring orange crates, 11 wooden orange crates, any wood that we could find, scrap wood in our neighborhoods. And we proceeded over the early weeks of this church. She brought in tools for little hands. We learned to work cooperatively, and we built a train. We put wheels on these orange crates and two seats in each one. And this strung around the back of the classroom. We painted it. She got a big drum. We made an engine. And in those days, we're talking way back in the 40s, there were no field trips. But we took field trips every single week the rest of the year. We went to Salinas to visit the fish factories. We went to the areas where they mined for gold in Sacramento. We took turns being engineers and tour guides for all the 22 kids in that class. And that was the most beautiful train I've ever seen. And we enjoyed riding on it all year long. God help us. We need to invite the Spirit of God to ignite all of our imaginations, particularly the creativity of our young people, to imagine, create new ways of being a difference, new ways of making a difference. Life is a design opportunity, and life is an opportunity to be the compassion of Christ in times like these.
Is there something to focus on that we've missed?
In chapter 4 of the book, one of the things that concerns me, because part of my story, I taught a worldview course for Fuller Theological Seminary in Seattle for over 3 decades, is evangelicals strongly claim that they live under the lordship of Christ and everything they do, you know, is biblically informed. And I don't think it's true. They bring scripture to bear on their spiritual life, their moral life, and their relationships. All important, all good. My mainline friends bring scripture to bear on social justice, racial justice, and the environment. All good. What's missing in almost all the theology I read, except Brueggemann and a couple of others, is virtually no one is bringing scripture to bear on cultural values. Cultural values, particularly our notion of good life and better future. Our notion of good life and better future, the American dream, defines where our time goes, where our money goes, and what we raise kids for. If we don't fundamentally redefine our sense of what's important, what's of value biblically, we're lost in space, because the Instagram envy culture is going to continue to take over our lives and the lives of our young people, defining our sense of what's important, what's of value, and anything that is vitally spiritual is going to go away. So we need to help people redefine the good life of God and then discover all of life is an opportunity for creativity and imagination, creating a way of life that's more festive, but we have more time to be present to God and present to neighbor. Because shorthand, the good life of God for followers of Jesus is never found in seeking life. It's only found in losing life in service to God and others. And so we need to help people redefine what in the hell they're on the planet for. And it's not just getting all the cool stuff and showing up to church when you can make it. It really has to do with becoming a countercultural presence in society, of a new festive way of life that really, really gives a damn about our neighbors and our neighborhoods as central, and a life of devoted spirituality to the God who created us and the God who loves us in Jesus Christ.
You've been listening to my conversation with author Tom Sein. Thanks to Tom's publisher, Cascade Books, an imprint of Wipfenstock, Whip Publishers, for the use of this interview adapted from a YouTube video. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or on our Facebook page or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. If you search the internet for Simple Living Radio, Simple Living Works takes a top slot on Stitcher, the most popular app for podcasts on mobile devices. We've received some encouraging response lately. in regard to episode 69 with Walter Brueggemann, Jean Ludvigsen Binder said, "Very interesting discussion. Interesting Jubilee perspective and the influence of the people of God on how society is organized for our mutual good." In regard to my blog, Alternatives Founder Has Died, Peggy Mühlenheisen Stalin simply said, "Peace and prayers." In regard to my blog about our new daily Simple Living Nudge, Bernita Kennan said, "Yes, sounds good." Simple living works. Yes, voluntary simplicity is not only effective, satisfying, faithful, and comprehensive, it also gets to work. It requires effort, psychologically and spiritually, to break wasteful habits and find earth-friendly ones, and then practically to implement and maintain those positive habits. I've started a new service to encourage our efforts called our Simple Living Daily Nudge. Each entry is indexed, so if you miss a day, you can catch up. Subscriptions are free on Twitter and by email. Weekly editions are planned for LinkedIn and Facebook. So if you're not already receiving Simple Living Works on those social media, sign up right away. A full description is given on the Simple Living Works website. Visit simplelivingworks.org. Click on Nudge in window number 2. Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works and would like more basic information about our organization, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't already subscribed, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It's not a list of rules, nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, "Live simply that others may simply live," as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that is quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce half-hour podcasts twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Learn to live simply so others can live.